Good afternoon. This is Dr. Dan Guerra. This is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 26 March 2024. And because we like to follow a numerical order, this is going to be lecture number 6 in my biochemical mosaic number 3. And of course, we're discussing, in the general sense, inflammasomes. So we were starting to talk in some detail about Staph aureus. And that means we get to talk about various forms of programmed cell death. So you know that the human innate immune defense contributes to no small measure for microbial clearance during infection and subsequent to infection, the replication of potentially replicating pathogens such as bacteria. Now the defenses that can be launched against bacterial infections include, of course, antimicrobial peptides. Now, this can be elaborated on the skin or on mucosal surfaces. Once the bacterium is beyond that outer integument or barrier, the recruitment of immune cells, typically initially innate immune cells, will then be activated. And not only that, potentiation of antibody production from B cells and, of course, T cell mediated immune responses. And with the B cells, it would be a complement system adjunct to that. And there's also, of course, in the blood, a coagulation cascade. So there's multiple lines of innate immune defense, and then couple that to the acquired immune response, either memory B cells or occasionally T cells. T cells and B cells can, of course, be finally recruited in the full stages of a fully launched immune response to even such infections as normal bacteria pathogens. Now, another major component of the immune response is PCD, that's programmed cell death, of course. And that adds just yet another mechanism to thwart any potential infection. Among the different cell death programs, there is, of course, canonical apoptosis, which we've talked about several times in Authentic Biochemistry. But there's also the regulated ischemic-associated irreversible necrosis, that's known as necrotosis, and then the regulated inflammatory microbiocidal pyrotosis. And they've been described having, of course, unique upstream and downstream signaling pathways for initiation, activation, and execution of those particular forms of programmed cell death. So apoptosis is often activated to release intracellular pathogens from otherwise infected host cells or tissues such that the host removes the preferred niche for the infection. And then there is an initial replication upon simultaneous exposure to nascent pathogen. And this can play out in extracellular immune cell defense responses. Of course, that can include inflammation. But necrotosis and pyrotosis, unique forms of programmed cell death, as I've been saying, are highly inflammatory. Of course, with apoptosis, because of the way that programmed cell death occurs, the amount of inflammation is very, very low. Cell basically commits suicide, an infected cell commits suicide, and does not treat the adjacent cells to signaling such that a pro-inflammatory response becomes systemic or even localized systemic. Okay, but necrotosis, pyrotosis is totally different. Highly inflammatory response. It's going to impact the entire innate and acquired immune response. And because of that, there are going to be associated host diseases because of the hyperinflammatory response. And that can be associated with pathogenic microorganismal infection. Okay. So, more detail here. Unlike apoptosis, pyroptosis denotes a highly inflammatory state that depends on the activation of interleukin 1 beta converting enzyme known, of course, as caspase 1. Now, remember the name caspase comes from cysteine-dependent aspartate-specific protease. So the enzymatic properties are governed by a stringent specificity for protein substrates that have as the target for this launched response of proteolytic activity an aspartic acid residue. And then there is the use of a cysteine side chain for the catalytic peptide bond cleavage mechanism, coming, of course, from the enzyme. So the use of that cysteine side chain acts as a nucleophile during peptide bond hydrolysis. And that's actually pretty common among many different kinds of protease families, right? But caspase is the one we're talking about here. So caspase 1 synthesized as an inactive zymogen. A zymogen just means an enzyme that's not functional until it is converted to the active form, right? And caspase 1 was actually the very first cysteine-dependent aspartate-specific protease that was discovered and then completely characterized. This was many decades ago now. Now, the processing and subsequent proteolytic cleavage of caspase 1 occurs within the inflammasome. And, you know, so that means it's occurring within that supermolecular complex platform. Right. And that means that caspase 1 activation and inflammasomes seem to cooperate, perhaps through evolutionary time, to regulate not only the inflammatory response, but infection in general. Okay. Infection of potentially pathogenic agents such as bacteria. Now, processing and subsequent proteolytic cleavage of caspase 1 occurs within the inflammasome, and it is linked to the NLRs. Remember, those are the NOD-like receptors. So that's why you're going to have an NLRP3. It's going to be a peptide associated with NOD-like reception. Remember that all those NLRs have a carboxy terminal leucine-rich repeat, an LLRR. Now, that is a structural domain shared actually with toll-like receptors. That's correct. And so another evolutionary patterning linked to pathogen-associated danger signals, including bacterial or viral nucleic acids, peptides, and membrane fragments. Okay. So the inflammasome-associated NLRs are endowed with a variable amino-terminal region that consists of the caspase activation and a recruitment domain that's called CARD, or a PYRIN, P-Y-R-I-N, P-Y-D acronym subunit that interacts with the CARD domain containing the adapter protein ASC. Remember, that's the one, the SPEC protein. So the CARD domain facilitates binding and proteolytic cleavage of the zymogen caspase 1. See? So catalytically active caspase 1 cleaves the proforms of interleukin 1 beta, interleukin 18, and indeed interleukin 33 into the biologically active pro-inflammatory and secreted cytokines. Ultimately, that leads to a very powerful pro-inflammatory response that will dictate downstream recruitment of immune cells and all the pathophysiological outcome of the disease in general, including the potential for a hyperimmune chronic event, which will then result in the most robust of the disease presentation, sequelae. Now, inflammasome activated caspase 1 also cleaves, because it's protease, remember, a protein known as pro-gasdermin D. And as it turns out, gasdermin D is the actual protein executor functional domain for pyritosis. So, inflammasome activated caspase 1 cleaves gasdermin D to unmask its pore-forming activity. And that is the predominant consequence that initiates pyritosis. So the role of gasdermin D in limiting cytosolic DNA surveillance is what's going on here. See, so cytosolic DNA, you know, is sensed by the AIM2 and the cyclic GMP-AMP synthase, the C-gas sting pathway, which will lead to another activation of inflammasome, which we talked about earlier in this mosaic set of lectures. And that's going to be what? That's going to be a type 1 interferon response, right? Yes. So gasdermin D, activated by the AIM2 inflammasome, suppresses the C-gas-driven type 1 interferon response to cytosolic DNA, right? Because it's not needed in this response. It's another route. Remember that cytosolic DNA can also include what? Oxidized mitochondrial DNA because of mitochondrial damage because of early events of autophagy, mitophagy, or indeed programmed cell death, particularly the canonical apoptotic version, right? Of course. Okay. Now, interferon beta, interferon beta response to bacterial infection has been noticed to elevate in gasdermin D deficient mice. So interferon beta will respond to bacterial infection when gasdermin D is not expressed. You see? So there's a sensing between the two different pathways. So gasdermin D mediated negative regulation when it is expressed of interferon beta occurs in a pyritosis, interleukin 1 and interleukin 18 independent matter. That's correct. Mechanistically, how does this work? Gasdermin D, okay, the proteolytic active product of the pro-gasdermin D, gasdermin D depleted intracellular potassium via that membrane pore formation. And this potassium efflux from the cell is necessary and sufficient to inhibit the C-gas-dependent interferon beta response. Thus, you see that interferon regulatory module involving gasdermin D and potassium efflux is yet another of the many pattern recognition receptor phenomena for the immune response to be conditioned against specific infection. Okay. So the processing of gasdermin D leads to the release of a plasma membrane pore-forming subunit. This is how it actually works. That subunit is called GSDMD N domain. And that will interact with, of course, acidic phosphoglycerol lipids. And where do we find acidic phosphoglycerol lipids? You'll know this from a previous mosaic series of lectures. But you're going to find that on the inner leaflet of the plasma membrane in mammals, of course. Now, remember that acidic phospholipids can also occur as Witter ions, depending on what? On whether or not proton is lost because of the change in pH, which can occur when phosphoglycerol lipids move through the plasma membrane because of such enzymatic reactions as flipases, which remember are controlled by ATPase machinery, which comes from the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay. So there is this microvesicle shedding and GSD MD N-terminal derived plasma membrane pores, which facilitate the rapid release of pro-inflammatory cytokines and indeed many other intracellular derived molecules into the extracellular space. And that ultimately drives swelling and osmotic lysis of the host cell. Okay. So you'll recognize that as presentation to disease. Now, another cytokine we need to talk about that we have in the past, and it comes actually from many different sources, but one of the major sources is from particular T cells called T17 cells. Now, interleukin 17A, pro-inflammatory cytokine, is a prototype of a family of cytokines that is generated, as I just said, from Th17 cells. Now, they're important in antimicrobial immunity, particularly during extracellular bacterial infections and fungal yeast infections. That's because that particular cytokine, 17A, is able to activate the CXC chemokine producing activity, consequently directing, because of chemokine gradients, right? And then the reception thereof of neutrophils to sites of infection. Yeah. Now you're understanding more about how the immune system works in its complex form. And this isn't nearly as complex as it can finally become. This is just, I guess graduate level understanding of the immune response. Now, mice, postgraduate is what you really want to get to. Mice deficient in interleukin 17 are highly susceptible to a number of bacterial and fungal infections, as you might guess, including things like Klebsiella, E. coli, and Candida albicans. Okay. Now, in the context of Staph aureus infection, once the Staph aureus is penetrated through the mucosa or the skin, IL-17 probably plays a very significant role. And it seems to be related to what's known as the hyper-IgE syndrome in patients who have an impaired Th17 cell response. Because they will suffer from, because they have hyper-IgE, recurrent Staph aureus infections. I actually knew someone that had that disorder. He was actually a microbiologist. Probably got it because he worked a lot with infectious bacteria. Now, in fact, when you work long enough with infectious bacteria, from what you understand from clinical microbiologists, you're going to pick up bacteria that, of course, are resistant to antibiotics. In this case, that's what happened to this friend of mine. Now, patients with atopic dermatitis have increased susceptibility to colonization by S. aureus. And this has in part been ascribed to a decreased interleukin 17 production. Okay? So the importance of the innate source of interleukin 17 is also involved in our understanding in the literature of the Staph aureus pathogenic response. Because if interleukin 17 doesn't come from Th17 cells, but rather comes from gamma delta T cells, and remember those are a natural killer type T cell, and lymphoid tissue inducer cells like LTIs, they may predominate in the skin and mucosa, preventing Staph aureus from moving beyond that barrier. So the gamma delta T cells and the LTI cells, if they predominate in the skin and mucosa, Staph aureus doesn't go any further because those two cells also are potent sources of interleukin 17. Okay. So that's just an anecdotal detail. Now, pharmacological inhibition of our friend galactin 3 galactin 3, with a compound known as Davinat, attenuates autoimmune cholangitis, something we started this series of lectures on. Suppressed serum levels of anti-PDCE2, IgA, AST, and ALT. Okay? Those are all going to be indicators of the disease, right? Presentations. But also expression of the NLRP3 inflammasome, associated interleukin-1 beta production, and then the influx of TH1, TH2, and TH17 cells into the liver, all with reduced liver fibrosis. That's correct. Okay. So cholangitis, then, is an inflammatory disorder of the bile duct. We mentioned this already. The bile duct carries, of course, bile from your liver to the gallbladder, and this is then associated with the first part of the small intestine, duodenum, right? Most cases of cholangitis are caused by bacterial infection, and this can happen quite suddenly, like right after the ingestion of the bacteria, such as bacterially contaminated food. That's correct. Now, significantly reduced influx of TH1, TH17, and TH2 cells is identified in the liver of galactin 3 inhibitor treated mice. And that's when you have a recombinant knockout of galactin 3. So it seems like galactin 3 is involved in the recruitment, probably via the inflammasome response, of these very potent T helper cells. Okay. One of which is TH17, which is going to produce interleukin 17. So galactin 3 plays an important pro-inflammatory role then in that bacterial infection caused by N aromatoseverans that we've been talking about. Remember that? That particular bacterial infection induces autoimmune cholangitis, and it's probably due to the dominant role of the inflammasome because of an induced activation of dendritic cells and macrophages, resulting in the activation of all the other players in the pathogenesis of PBC, of that cholangitis, in particular interleukin 17 containing natural killer, cytotoxic T lymphocytes, and those T helper cells, including the gamma delta Ts. So the inhibition then of GAL3 signaling is considered a potential therapeutic strategy for PBC, that is primary biliary cholangitis. You understand? So a lot of these immune responses are really what cause the disease. It's the immune response. So you have an infection, but the infection might well be cleared eventually because of the immune response. But the immune response is what's causing the major morbidity of the infection. So drugs which inhibit galactin 3, which would drop that entire inflammasome response, might allow for bacterial infection to proceed, but which would eventually be overcome either by antibody production from B cells or from pyrotosis or potentially from cytotoxic T lymphocytes onto infected cells. You see, once that bacterium becomes intracellular. All right. Now, we talked about this before, but I have to bring it up. I want to bring it up because I love DNA repair mechanisms, okay? Because it reminds me of my homologous recombination research days. So base excision repair, okay? That's known as BER, certain kind of repair, right? Inhibits NLRP3 inflammasome activation and even sterile inflammatory induction. Okay. Now, why is that? Well, remember, oxymitochondrial DNA is associated with atherosclerosis. We talked about this last time, maybe the time before last. Now, of course, That disease, atherosclerosis, is actually involved with 8-oxoguanine DNA glycosylase 1. Now, that is the OGG1 enzyme, and that is a base excision repair protein. And it removes 8-oxo-G from damaged, typically mitochondrial, cytosolic DNA. And that declines over time while the NLRP3 inflammasome activity becomes augmented because of this processing. You see? So genetic OGG1 deficiency actually increases the risk of, wait for it, Alzheimer's disease. Because the pathogenesis of that disorder includes amplification of the NLRP3 inflammasome. Okay. And that means that Alzheimer's disease has an autoimmune disease corollary. So OGG1 deficiency increases susceptibility to other autoimmune diseases associated, for example, with obesity and obesity-linked metabolic disorder, which of course is going to enhance type 1 interferon production, and cutaneous manifestation of pristine-induced lupus disease. See how these are connected? So, although OGG1 is known for its nuclear function, because it's a base excision repair enzyme, it also localizes to the mitochondria, and that's where it's maintaining mitochondrial DNA integrity, and why it functions on the 8-oxo-G DNA generated from damaged mitochondria during autophagy, certain forms of apoptosis, as well as certain autoimmune responses with or without bacterial or viral infection. So indeed, mitochondrially targeted OGG1. When we target the OGG1 in transgenic mice, they become resistant to an alum-induced NLRP3 inflammasome activation. And of course, what's downstream from that, the interleukin-1 beta dependent peritonitis. Okay. Whereas alum challenged mitochondrial OGG1 transgenic mice exhibit reduced interleukin-1 beta and neutrophil monocyte infiltration relative to the wild-type counterpoint. That suggests then there is a change in another protein, and that would be tumor necrosis factor alpha. Okay, for reasons that I don't need to get into, but you see how these immune responses are linked. So the NLRP3 inflammasome also instigates the acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. Yes, in which lung, and this is a very high morbidity and mortality disease in humans, fortunately. This is when lung parenchyma and resident immune cells generate massive amounts of interleukin-1 beta and interleukin-18. That drives chronic high morbidity pulmonary inflammation. Okay. So this is curious because mitochondrial OGG1 transgenic mice actually are resistant to, in the mouse model, in the murine model, an LPA-induced ARDS. That displays reduced pulmonary vascular endothelial damage, interstitial edema, in both macrophage and neutrophil infiltration of the alveolar wall and collagen deposition, all of which are typical presentations for ARDS, you see. Okay, so you see how these discussion of one particular disease pathway opens up a discussion of multiple disease pathways. Okay. Now that poor opening.